Beyond Barbarossa, episode 90. Budapest lay athwart the main entry route to Austria and Bohemia. It was the main railway hub of the region and also the largest Danubian port. The Red Army could not bypass it. This was the first time in the war that the Red Army had to lay siege to a major city. Welcome to Beyond Barbarossa, the first English-language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. I'm Scott Burry, podcasting from the Redbeard Studio on traditional Anishinaabeg Algonquin territory, also called Ottawa, in free, independent, and sovereign Canada. And I'm joined in the studio today by Daisy the Danger Doodle, my indispensable assistant, lying there asleep on the carpet. Just a reminder, you can get episodes of Beyond Barbarossa early and ad-free by subscribing and supporting on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and choose any level of support you feel comfortable with. Patreon supporters also get occasional bonus episodes, and this month I'm going to throw in a special picture of Daisy the Danger Doodle. As you know, this podcast attempts to describe the history of the Second World War's Eastern Front chronologically, with an 81-year delay. And as the calendar on my wall shows December 2025, it means this podcast is getting to the end of 1944, a significant time in the history of the war. So let's recap the past 12 months on the Eastern Front. In January 1944, the Eastern Front ran mostly along the Dnipro River in Ukraine and Belarus, then followed an uneven line mostly northward, east of Lake Ilmen in western Russia, and then barely south of Leningrad to the coast of the Gulf of Finland. The Red Army had pushed the Germans back from Leningrad, opening better supply lines into the city in January 1943, and had recaptured Kyiv, Ukraine, in November of that year. At the celebration meeting of the Moscow Soviet of Working People's Deputies and Moscow Party and Public Organizations in November 1944, good grief, don't you just love these communist names and titles for things? They're exhausting. At that meeting, Joseph Stalin, General Secretary of the USSR and head of the military, well, dictator of the USSR, said, quote, "The decisive successes of the Red Army this year and the expulsion of the Germans from Soviet territory were predetermined by the succession of shattering blows which our troops dealt the German forces, beginning as far back as last January and continuing throughout the year under review." End quote. These 10 shattering blows were: 1. The liberation of Leningrad, when the Red Army pushed the Germans back from Leningrad and Novgorod, lifting the siege completely in January. 2. The reconquest of western Ukraine to the Dniester River and the slopes of the Carpathian Mountains in February and March. 3. the reconquest of Crimea in April and May, opening Crimean ports as well as Odessa to the USSR. The fourth shattering blow happened in Karelia on the Finnish border and around Lake Ladoga, called the Vyborg-Petrozavodsk Offensive by historians. This pushed the Finnish forces back to the border established at the end of the Winter War in 1940, when the Soviets captured Finnish territory, including the city of Vyborg, or Viipuri in Finnish. The fifth shattering blow was Operation Bagration, which drove the Germans completely out of Belorussia, now known as Belarus. As Stalin said, quote, "The Red Army utterly routed the German forces at Vitebsk, Bobrusk, and Mogilev. This blow culminated in the encirclement of 30 German divisions at Minsk," end quote. The Red Army also reconquered most of Lithuania and reached the eastern bank of the Vistula River, and therefore Warsaw, capital of Poland. And then they refused to help the legitimate government of Poland liberate Warsaw, but rather let the Germans and Poles kill each other to make their takeover of the country easier. This podcast covered that history in episodes 78 and in 83, but really all the episodes in between are important too. So if you need a refresher, go ahead and listen to them again. The sixth shattering blow was the Lvov-Sandomierz offensive from mid-July to the end of August. This completed the Soviet Union's reconquest of the last corner of Western Ukraine. We covered that in episode 80. Seventh shattering blow, the Jassy-Kishinev offensive from 19 to 29 August, which captured or drove the Germans out of the Soviet state of Moldavia, now known as Moldova, an independent country. Not only did this result in the encirclement of 12 German divisions, only a fraction of whom broke out, it also caused, well, put it this way, on 23rd August, the young King Michael of Romania staged a coup, ousted military dictator and Nazi friend Marshal Ion Antonescu, and switched sides from the Axis to the Allies. Soon after, Bulgaria also switched sides to the Allies. Hitler's regime had just lost two crucial, if junior, partners, whose forces would now be fighting against them. Even worse, the Germans had lost their main source of fuel, Romania's Ploiesti oil fields. Fuel shortages had always been a problem for the Wehrmacht, and now they would get even worse. Germany's last remaining source of fuel was the oil fields around Lake Balaton, west of Budapest, Hungary. Eighth shattering blow, the Baltic offensive, from September to November. Notice how these shattering blows overlap in time? That's important. So in the Baltic offensive, the Red Army swept across Estonia and Latvia with a huge offensive in Riga, the Latvian capital. This led to two pockets of German forces pinned against the Baltic Sea in Courland, western Latvia, and the city of Memel, now Klaipeda, Lithuania, as well as the border of East Prussia, the heartland of German militarism. This was not a siege, though, as the pockets still had access over the Baltic Sea for resupplies. The ninth shattering blow comprised two operations. First, the Red Army, with its new Romanian and Bulgarian buddies, moved into Yugoslavia. They linked up with Tito's communist partisans, and I think the appropriate word in this case is liberated Belgrade, as well as most of Yugoslavia, but not all, not yet, quite. And the second part of the ninth shattering blow was the invasion of Hungary. This also involved an incursion into eastern Slovakia, concurrent with a rising there against the Germans, as described in episode 87. Final shattering blow, number 10, the Petsamo-Kirkenes offensive in the far north of Finland, on the shores of the Arctic Ocean. This brought the USSR to the border of Norway. Now, at the end of the year, the German situation appears to be hopeless. Where in 1942 their new empire had stretched from France's Atlantic coast to the Volga River and the Caucasus Mountains, and from the Arctic Ocean to Africa, map 2 on the webpage shows you just how much they've lost in 2 years. But it's important not to fall victim to the hindsight fallacy. We know in 2025 that by the end of 1944, the war was in its final months. And we tend to think that at this point, Germany's defeat was inevitable. It was. But remember, the people there at the time did not know that. It was obvious, I think, to anyone that could see reality, that Germany could not defeat the combined Allied forces, especially now that some of its partners, its own allies, had deserted it. Now, before we get into the last weeks and days of 1944 on the Eastern Front, it's time for our regular feature, What Else Is Happening in the War? December 3rd, British Army officers and police shoot unarmed protesters in Athens, even though they chant Viva Churchill, Viva Roosevelt, Viva Stalin. Meanwhile, in the UK, the British stand down the Home Guard, the volunteer militia who, although ineligible for military service for age or medical reasons, observed the skies and seas against possible attacks, defended key transport hubs, factories, and conducted other rear echelon operations. With the Allied armies at the border of Germany, east and west, the likelihood of a German invasion seemed more remote, hence no more need for the Home Guard. 5th December, the Allies have complete control of Ravenna on Italy's northern Adriatic coast. And meanwhile, the American recapture of the Philippines continues. On 14 December, Japanese troops kill more than 100 American prisoners of war in the Palawan massacre. Meanwhile, planes from aircraft carrier USS Ticonderoga hit Japanese positions on Luzon, the largest Philippine island. 15 December, U.S. and Filipino troops land on Mindoro Island in the Philippines. That evening, UK time, band leader Major Glenn Miller goes missing while on a flight from London to Paris. The same day, the Germans evacuate Urunu Island in the Gulf of Riga, their last outpost in Estonia, although it's closer to Latvia. 16 December, the 5th, 6th, and 7th German armies begin the Ardennes Offensive in Belgium and Luxembourg against the U.S. 1st Army, a drive to recapture the Belgian port of Antwerp. This, the last major German offensive of the war, becomes known as the Battle of the Bulge. This will have a significant impact on the Eastern Front as, in the words of eminent World War II historian and friend of the podcast, Anthony Tucker Jones, instead of reinforcing the crumbling Eastern Front, the rejuvenated and re-equipped forces that had been so masterfully assembled in late 1944 were thrown away in the Ardennes and Alsace. End quote. On 17 December, SS soldiers of Kampfgruppe Pieper murder 84 U.S. prisoners of war in Belgium. This becomes known as the Malmedy Massacre. Meanwhile, in the Pacific, Typhoon Cobra, or Halsey's Typhoon, sinks three destroyers of the U.S. Pacific Fleet east of the Philippines. 18 December. German forces surround the town of Bastogne, Belgium, and the members of the U.S. 101st Airborne Division, the all-African-American 969th Artillery Battalion, and Combat Command B of the 10th Armored Division. On the 22nd, German General Heinrich von Luttwitz sends a demand for the surrender. Acting commander of the 101st Airborne, Brigadier General Anthony McAuliffe, despite his men running out of food and ammunition, gives the immortal response, "Nuts," in writing. 23rd December. Skies over the Ardennes begin to clear, and the Allies launch airstrikes on German supply points behind the lines in the Battle of the Bulge. They also drop supplies for the troops in Bastogne. British forces hold the Meuse River crossings at Dinant, Givette, and Namur. V-1 flying bombs hit Manchester, England. The U.S. 2nd Army Division attacks the German 2nd Panzer Division at the Meuse River in Belgium, cutting them off from retreat. General Hassel van Manteuffel, commander of the 5th Panzer Army, recommends calling off the operation and falling back to the West Wall, the defensive Siegfried Line along the pre-war German border. German dictator Führer Adolf Hitler, of course, refuses. Christmas Day, 1944. fighting in the Battle of the Bulge continues. The 47th Panzer Corps, along with the understrength 26th Volksgrenadier Division and 901st Regiment, try to capture the crossroads at Bastogne. The Americans destroy all the German tanks. 26 December. Two divisions of the U.S. 3rd Army under General George Patton come north from northeastern France into Belgium, and in the late afternoon reach Bastogne, ending the siege. 26 to 27 December, surrounded in the Ardennes, the 2nd Panzer Division tries to break out, but the Americans capture a lot of their equipment. This is the end of the Germans' operation and the end of their major offensives in the West. Now to focus on Hungary and the Red Army's advance on the capital, Budapest. And we'll do that right after this short break.
As Scott elegantly describes in each episode of Beyond Barbarossa, the war on the Eastern Front was truly gargantuan, both in terms of its geography and its destructiveness. But given that there is so much territory to cover, and that so many millions of men were involved in the fighting, it's perhaps inevitable that some battles from the Eastern Front get overlooked. I'm David Sumner, and I'm the host of Europe at War, a weekly podcast exploring lesser-known battles and stories of the Second World War with a particular focus on the Eastern Front. From the drama of thousands of trapped German soldiers and terrified civilians attempting to break out of the Halber Pocket, to the unexpected and blistering counterattack launched by German forces on the Red Army during the Battle of Bautzen, many of the Eastern Front's most dramatic battles, particularly those which happened towards the end of the war, have long been neglected by historians, and their stories have remained untold. Until now. So to hear these incredible tales from the Eastern Front, and more, check out Europe at War, available on all podcast platforms. Thank you. Now let's get back to the show.
Hi, Scott here. I hope you're enjoying this episode and that you get a lot out of the whole podcast. Beyond Barbarossa is still, as far as I can tell, the only English language podcast in the world that focuses on the Eastern Front of World War II. If you do like it and you want to help me keep it going, please give it a rating or a review on Apple, Google, Amazon, Podbean, or whatever podcasting platform you listen to it on. That helps let other people know about it. Patreon's another way you can support the podcast, my research, and podcasting expenses. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and sign up at whatever level of support you choose. Patreon supporters get early, ad-free access to new episodes, as well as exclusive bonus episodes on topics like the Winter War between the USSR and Finland and the pre-Barbarossa invasion of Poland by Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union in 1939. Check it out, won't you? Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Thanks.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more about my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel, and all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now, let's get back to Scott, exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Welcome to part 2 of episode 90 of Beyond Barbarossa, the first English language podcast to focus on the entire history of the Eastern Front of the Second World War. I'm Scott Burry, and for part 2, I'm joined in the studio by my other indispensable assistant, Ragnar the Magnificent Ragdoll Cat. Daisy the Danger Doodle has taken up her afternoon post as sentry guard from the upstairs window, so if you hear a dog barking or growling, it's because Daisy is warning off a very dangerous other dog walking with their owner down the street. It's reassuring to know I'm so well protected. This episode, we're looking at the Red Army's assault on Budapest, capital of Hungary, and the siege that followed. By the end of 1944, Hungary's people were more than tired of the war. In 3 years of fighting alongside the Germans in the USSR, some 200,000 Hungarians had been killed. And then, starting in April 1944, the United States Air Force and the Royal Air Force had been bombing Budapest. So the Hungarians were ready to end the war in 1944, and in fact, tried to do so twice. Regular listeners know about ruler Regent Miklos Horthy's attempt to come to a separate peace with the USSR earlier in the year. Germany responded to that by occupying Hungary in Operation Margareta on 19 March 1944, sending in three divisions and forcing Horthy to fire his prime minister and appoint someone that would cooperate with them. Horthy complied by appointing Doma Stole. But as the Red Army approached the Hungarian border with their new Romanian allies, Horthy tried again. He negotiated a separate peace with the Soviets in September 1944. Hitler caught wind of this, of course, and launched Operation Panzerfaust to take over the country directly. According to historian Evan Mosley in Thunder in the East, the Nazi-Soviet War of 1941-1945, the attitude of the Hungarian armed forces was of critical importance. There were only a half a dozen Wehrmacht divisions in the country and 25 Hungarian ones. The chief of the Hungarian General Staff, General Janos Voros, ordered his forces to cease fire on the Red Army. One of his commanders, General Miklos, commanding the 1st Hungarian Army in the northeast, went over to the Russians, which dislocated the defense of the Carpathians. But Miklos's subordinate commanders did not follow him, and meanwhile, the 2nd and 3rd Hungarian armies also proved more loyal to the Axis cause. In the end, much of the Hungarian army fought alongside the Germans, in marked contrast to what had happened in Romania. As General Volos told Marshal Malinovsky, quote, "The Germans learned a great deal from the experience of Romania and Bulgaria, and especially of Romania." One of the senior Hungarian officers who went over to the Russians explained that the reason some of the population and the army sided with the Germans was fear of the expected atrocities of the Soviet army. The intelligentsia and officers are convinced of their total destruction. The people fear that they will be deprived of their property and sent to Siberia. They expect that all women will be raped. It was very important, too, that local rivals, the Romanians, were now fighting on the Allied side and threatening to gain territory from Greater Hungary. End quote. On 15 October, Horthy announced over Budapest radio that he had negotiated an armistice with the USSR. But the Germans were ready. SS commandos attacked, beat, and kidnapped Horthy's son, Miklos Jr. They imprisoned him at the Mauthausen concentration camp and later at Dachau. After Horthy Sr. signed off the broadcast, the Hungarian Nazi collaborators, the Arrow Cross Party, took over the radio station with SS help. The SS then arrested Horthy Sr., forced him to sign a statement renouncing the armistice and abdicating in favor of his former friend, Ferenc Selassie, or Horthy Jr.'s life would be forfeit. More German soldiers came to bolster the occupation forces, two Waffen-SS divisions comprising the 9th SS Mountain Corps. This brought the total to some 79,000 troops in Budapest, including the Hungarians. That sounds like a lot, 79,000 troops concentrated in one city. But by the end of October, the Red Army troops from both the 2nd Ukrainian Front and the 3rd Ukrainian Front, as well as the Romania's 7th Army Corps, were advancing across the Hungarian plain toward the capital on the Danube. This force included close to 1 million troops. For those of you who love these details, this force included the 53rd Red Army, the 7th Guards Army, and the 46th Army, plus Romanian forces. Malinovsky divided the forces into two maneuver groups, advancing toward Budapest from the north and the south. By 7th November, they had reached the outskirts of Budapest, 20 kilometers from the city center. Now, a bit of description of the Hungarian capital. It's actually two cities, Buda on the hilly western or right bank of the Danube, and Pest on the flatter eastern side. So, as the Red Army approached from the east, the German and Hungarian defenders withdrew to the west, where they had higher ground and therefore a better view of their approaching enemy. I'll turn again to friend of the podcast, Anthony Tucker Jones, to describe the action. The Soviets launched a fresh assault on 5th December, aiming to trap the city in a pincer movement. The Soviet 7th Guards and 6th Guards tank armies and Pliev's mechanized cavalry group struck from the northeast, while the 46th Army attacked from the southwest. 4 days later, they had got as far as Shahi and the Danube to the north of the city. While the 46th got across the river, it was at great cost, and it still could not get through the defenses to the southwest. End quote. While this didn't completely encircle Budapest, it meant that the Red Army had taken significant ground north and south of the city, and importantly, extending well to the west. The pincer was developing. Quoting again, on 12th December 1944, the 2nd and 3rd Ukrainian fronts were instructed to take Budapest. The 2nd Ukrainian front on the left was to attack from Shahi. Scott here, the Shahi is a city now in Slovakia, about 90 kilometers or 50 miles north of Budapest. Now back to Anthony Tucker Jones. From Shahi, southward to the Danube north of Esztergom, about 45 kilometers northwest of Buda, which would cut off any German retreat to the northwest. The 3rd Ukrainian front was directed to move northward from Lake Valenci and link up with the 2nd Ukrainian front near Esztergom. End quote. In other words, they were closing the vise, or more accurately, pushing the jaws of the vise farther west, putting Budapest deep within the open maw. Back to Anthony Tucker Jones. This offensive commenced on 20 December, and within 6 days the two fronts had met, encircling the Hungarian capital. Hitler's last ally was now knocked out of the war. The Wehrmacht was on its own. End quote. The siege of Budapest began in earnest on Christmas Eve 1944. By the 26th, the Red Army had cut the road to Vienna. The encirclement of Budapest was closed. 33,000 German and 37,000 Hungarian soldiers, as well as 800,000 civilians, had no way to escape. The new Nazi-friendly dictator of Hungary, Szalasi, wanted to withdraw from the capital and declare it an open city, letting the defenders attempt to break out of the trap. Once again, Hitler refused permission. As he had done so many times before, he declared Budapest a festung, a fortress city that must be defended to the last man's last bullet. As he had done so many times before, he refused to see that this never worked. To be fair, there were good reasons to want to hold on to Budapest, again from Evan Maudsley's Thunder in the East. Budapest lay athwart the main entry route to Austria and Bohemia. It was the main railway hub of the region and also the largest Danubian port. The Red Army could not bypass it. This was the first time in the war that the Red Army had to lay siege to a major city. End quote. Let's not forget that beyond Budapest was Hungary's Lake Balaton region, the last remaining source of petroleum for Germany. Without oil, Germany could not continue to fight. Fuel shortages, as I've said many times on this podcast, were a perennial problem for the Germans. Quoting from Antony Beevor's The Second World War, Hitler's special envoy, Edmund Wiesenmeier, who was head of the commandos who had kidnapped and beaten Miklos Horthy Jr., Wiesenmeier insisted on the Führer's instruction that Budapest should be defended to the last brick. It did not matter, he said, if Budapest was destroyed 10 times, so long as Vienna could thereby be defended. End quote. And to quote from Anthony Tucker Jones, despite the countless casualties they inflicted, the Germans and Hungarians knew they could not hold back the enemy flood. End quote. On 27 December, the Germans lost Ferihegy Airport in Budapest, where they brought in most of their supplies. They had to resort to landing small aircraft on wide streets or parks in the city, which was very risky because of the constant Soviet artillery fire. Hunger really began to bite when the Danube froze over. Some German soldiers even resorted to eating their own horses. There are stories about two attempts by the Red Army to negotiate a German surrender at Budapest. However, there are multiple versions of the story, and it's impossible to know where the truth lies. The basic version is that the Red Army sent two groups of emissaries to negotiate surrender terms on 29 December 1945. At 10 o'clock in the morning, three representatives from the 3rd Ukrainian Front, this was the group who was advancing from the south, came to the German military commander in Budapest, General Pfeffer Wildenbruch. He refused the conditions and sent the Soviets away. According to the first version of events, as the emissaries were crossing no man's land, the Germans shot at them, killing the leader, Captain Ostapenko. The others managed to escape back to Soviet lines. An hour later, representatives of the 2nd Ukrainian Front, the group that came to Budapest from the north, approached the German lines, and the Germans shot at them before they met any officers. One version of the story is that German fire killed them. Another is that they were killed by friendly fire responding from the Soviet side. Yet a third story is that they stepped on landmines as they were fleeing. Whichever is true, or if the truth is somehow completely different, the result was that the Germans and Hungarians refused to surrender to the Soviets. They had to have heard the stories of the brutal treatment, the looting, deportations, murders, and mass rapes committed by the Red Army in other cities they liberated. As the war moved into its final months, this knowledge would cause millions of Germans to resist the Red Army as they fled, in the hopes of surrendering to the Americans or British. On 1st January, the 4th SS Panzer Corps attacked from the northwest of the city in their first attempt to relieve the siege. Operation Conrad. The Soviets responded by sending four more divisions into the fight, so the relief operation failed. The Germans tried again in Operation Conrad II on 7 January. That also failed, and the Germans ended the attempt on 12th January. Fighting raged in the streets of Budapest between snipers and small groups of soldiers. I found this interesting quote on Wikipedia. Soviet troops quickly found themselves in the same situation as the Germans had in Stalingrad. They were able to take advantage of the urban terrain by relying heavily on snipers and sappers to advance. End quote. You'll remember that the Germans called the urban fighting in Stalingrad Rattenkrieg, or War Among the Rats, because all the rubble gave snipers and other troops on both sides many places to hide, making it very difficult for and dangerous for anyone, any force, to move through the city. But in Budapest, the battle raged below the streets as well. Both sides moved soldiers through the sewers. At one point, six Soviet Marines moved through sewers to Castle Hill. That's what it sounds like, the hill in central Buda where the royal castle was and the residence, until Operation Panzerfaust, of the regent. The Soviets got up there through the sewers and actually captured a German officer and took him to their own lines, all underground. The Germans also used the sewers to get behind the attackers. As time went on, the fighting became more and more like Stalingrad. Finally, on 17 January, Hitler allowed German forces to withdraw from Pest to Buda. And to their credit, the German officers on the ground had displayed great prescience by doing that weeks earlier. That brings us to early to mid-January 1945, and the next episode will be available on 5th January 1945. 2026. So we'll get into the next phase of the Siege of Budapest in the new year. And it is many other interesting aspects of the final days of the war. You and I know it will be the final few months of the Second World War, but as I said before, beware the trap of hindsight. The people there at the time couldn't know that the war would end on May 8th. But anyone with a sense of reality could tell that Germany was collapsing fast, and the end wasn't far off, but they could not know when exactly it would happen, nor could anyone there, military or civilian, be certain of surviving, of being alive on the day when the bullets stopped flying. I know that's a heavy thought to end on, so let me try to lighten the mood a little by wishing all of you a happy, healthy, and safe holiday season. I hope to talk to you again in the new year. Thank you for listening to Beyond Barbarossa, the podcast about the Eastern Front of the Second World War. As always, you can find maps and photos about this episode on the webpage, beyondbarbarossa.ca or beyondbarbarossa.podbean.com, and then click on the title for this episode. Please consider following Beyond Barbarossa on your preferred podcasting app, and I'd really appreciate a rating on whichever podcasting app you use. That really helps spread the word to others interested in history who don't know about this podcast yet. I want to also thank all who have supported the podcast through Patreon. Until all Ukrainian refugees can return home safely, your financial support goes to charities that help Ukrainian refugees. Patreon supporters get episodes early, ad-free, and with images, such as historical photos and maps. You, too, can support the show by sending your web browser to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Do you have something to say? A question? A comment? Maybe a correction? I hope I haven't made any errors, but, well, I wouldn't know. So, if you have something to say, you can reach me by email, scott@beyondbarbarossa.ca, or through the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. You can also reach me through Blue Sky and Instagram. I love to hear from listeners. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Burry. Morse code by Thane Brown. I'm Scott Burry. Until next time and next year, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina, Diva le Canada.